If food waste were a country, it would be the third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions behind China.
Wow.
In the United States. But it accounts for 11% of global emissions. The United States wastes by far the most out of any other country. And in order for us to attain that goal of reducing emissions by half within the next 9 years, we're going to need to make significant changes in our food system.
Welcome to the Growing the Green Economy podcast, where we talk with the innovators, policy leaders, and activists that are leading the transition to a sustainable green economy. I'm your host, Connor Bronsden, political and tech consultant and policy writer.
As climate change continues to rack the world, we need inspiring stories to remind us of what's possible. In this episode of Growing the Green Economy, I'm talking with one of the creators of FarmLink about addressing food waste, supply chains, and how mutual aid concepts can help. But first, I do need to disclose something. I recorded this episode all the way back in May of 2021, when I coincidentally started a new job at a startup that's taken a lot of my time. I'm finally having the opportunity and energy to jump back into producing this podcast. And I'll be back soon with another episode featuring Dr. Sylvia Earle, talking about how we can work to save our oceans. So keep an eye out for that, and apologies that this took so long to come out. Today with me, I have Aidan Riley, one of the co-founders of FarmLink. Aidan, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about the project and yourself?
Yeah, of course. FarmLink Project is a student-run volunteer nonprofit. We started it about a year ago, almost exactly, last April, when myself and my friend Jay were reading articles about food going to waste, while we knew that in our hometown of Los Angeles, food banks were getting overrun with new food insecure families and they were running out of food. So we thought, okay, those are maybe two problems that can help solve each other. And we began, first of all, calling friends. And we all as a group started cold calling these farms and asking, hey, do you have surplus? And if they did, then we said, what do you need to get that to a food bank? And a lot of the time they would say, I need this much money to cover my pick and pack out costs, or I need a truck, this or that. And we would basically end up gathering donations, renting a U-Haul, driving it to the farm, and then delivering it to the food bank ourselves. The project has grown since then. Like I said, we're a year old and we've moved 30 million pounds of food now. We're a team of 250 students
wow.
And in 50 states, and we are almost all 50 states, and we work in Mexico as well.
That's a ton of growth. So this was initiated because of issues that were happening with supply chains due to COVID-19.
It began as a reaction to the shock of seeing food being dumped during the pandemic due to supply chain breakdowns. I go to school here in Rhode Island, and let's say the farm that supplied this school of 6,000 people with all its food for cafeterias, suddenly all the students get sent home in the spring, the contracts get slashed, the farm can't pay to refrigerate and keep all that food. So they're forced to throw it out. That's what we targeted in the beginning. But very quickly, we recognized, okay, there's a much larger issue. We're talking about millions of pounds of produce during the pandemic, but tens of billions of pounds on any given year, irrespective of the pandemic. So yes, it did come about as a reaction to the pandemic, but this problem has existed before and will exist after.
What's going to change for you after the pandemic is over? Are you going to continue operations and just try to do it in a way that's more efficient, or what's going to change for you?
Yeah. Even just a couple months ago, we recognized, okay, this is something that could help people for a really long time because, yeah, we're talking about 20 billion pounds of farm produce that goes to waste, food that is almost identical to what is on the supermarket shelves. Mm-hmm. That going to waste per year when food insecurity, we're talking like 40% of Americans not knowing where their next meal is going to come from. Once we came to terms with that and learned that and saw it ourselves, it changed our whole scope. We figured, okay, we can help people for years after this. And so what we did is we started making long-term partnerships with not just farms that were suffering because of the pandemic, but now farms, very large ones such as Taylor Farms, that was having large weekly supply of surplus that they were sending to dump. And that we're willing to help. And these are the kind of partnerships that are going to help us in the future continue to be able to do this. And that's how we started to try to transition from that farmer with the pile of potatoes in his backyard to that industrial farm, which is wasting 5% a week or something like that, which amounts to tens of millions of pounds a year.
Do you think you'll be able to have as much or more of an impact once COVID is no longer disrupting supply chains? Or is there just going to be less availability for you to make an impact as you have been doing during the pandemic?
I think we're going to have more availability. but like it's such a behemoth problem. We move 30 million pounds, but that is just the tiniest drop in the bucket of what we can do. And that's totally, like I said, irrespective of the pandemic. And we're looking to make a legitimate dent in that 20 billion pound number.
Great.
So it's a lofty goal, but it's what it has to be done.
How did you end up expanding to Mexico? That's a whole nother kettle of fish.
We had a whole coalition of team members who were Mexican American and had connections in Mexico. And basically their connections in Mexico said, either their family members or friends or associates said, wow, that's great what you guys are doing up there. Do you know we have the same issue down here in Mexico, where of course we grow and provide a lot of the food that comes into the United States. We could use the same thing. So we've moved, I think, around 250,000 pounds of food within the last month and a half. And it's a different system. It's and we didn't want to guess that one shoe would fit the other foot.
Right. Yeah.
But what we did is we empowered people who live down there who are actually there to do it themselves.
Awesome. Can you tell me a bit more about the creation of this project and how that came about and how you realized it was such a problem?
The people who created this project was a small group of college students who were friends from before the pandemic. I'm talking myself, Will Collier, Ben Collier, James Knopf. And we were a loosely connected group of friends, some of whom didn't really know each other, but basically we all saw the same issue and we had nothing to do. We had just been sent home from school and our schools were paused. And I remember at the beginning of the pandemic thinking, as I was being sent home, oh my God, the grocery stores are overrun with people, not gonna be able to get food. And I'm afraid, oh, I'm gonna starve, this or that. And a couple weeks into quarantine, I recognized, oh, that's not the case. I'm privileged enough to be having meals every night. And the more I read about the people who actually were affected in that sense, it wasn't because the grocery stores were being overrun, it's because people were being put out of work. And millions of people who relied on food banks to usually normally get food, suddenly they're having to wait in 3-hour long lines to go get a bag of produce. And the banks were running out because there were no volunteers. And it was just a perfect storm of issues. And at the same time, if you're just seeing, for example, New York Times articles that show a mountain of potatoes 100 feet high that are going to a dump, it's like, that is completely illogical. And
absolutely,
you know, the best thing we did is there, let's just try. And so the articles that we were reading, learning about food waste, we basically called the farmers mentioned in those articles. We looked them up, found like their number online and called them. And we got hung up on maybe 150 times at the beginning, just cold calling. But eventually did get a response from a farmer outside of Los Angeles saying, hey, I have 12,000 eggs that you could come get, but I don't have a truck. So we rented a U-Haul. I drove it there on the 405 freeway in LA, picked it up, drove it back. It was super dangerous, like probably illegal too. I'm not totally sure, but then I unloaded them ourselves. And to be honest, I think part of the reason that we were able to grow very quickly was because the news of us doing this came at a time that was pretty dark.
People needed hope.
Yeah. Last year, mid-April, it was just a relentless torrent of bad news. And everyone was stuck at home to where he felt like he couldn't do anything about it. He felt very impotent against how to help people going hungry, how to help people getting sick, this or that. And I know everyone knows. And so I think the image of students who knew nothing about agriculture, farming or freight, just going out there trying it and being as scrappy as renting the truck themselves resonated. Like, it spread like crazy in the first 2 months because of that.
Out of curiosity, did anyone in your group have a supply chain background? I know you're a political science student at Brown, right?
Yeah, I am. But no, I definitely did not have a supply chain background. And no, nobody else did. So we didn't know. Yeah, we were super inexperienced. And I think that kind of worked in our favor because we didn't come in with any sort of arrogance. Like, we had to recognize, okay, there have been doing this, who have been running food banks and supplying food banks and saving surplus for years before we have. So the best thing we can do is try to learn from them and try to figure out how we can help them rather than be redundant, try to replace their efforts just so we can feel like heroes or something. So that's what we did in the beginning. It was a lot, in addition to calling farmers, was talking to people who have been doing this and learning and recruiting them and saying, come on the team. And so we just got up early on. Once we got in the New York Times and we got on ABC, people started to think, oh, this is a legitimate operation. We were able to recruit people who were so much smarter than we were and had so much more experience. That's been like the biggest factor, I think, in us being able to grow.
It sounds like you think your timing was really good, where you had an opportunity to help bring together these disparate folks who've been doing this, but maybe hadn't had the platform and the resources to really make it go as big as you've been able to help it go.
Yeah, I think the timing was good and the intent was right. We didn't set it out to be like, okay, let's do something huge that's going to get on the news or something that's going to get us like awards or resume builder or anything. It was just like, okay, there's a million things we don't know here. let's just figure out this one farm, one truck, one food bank. We can do that. We can at least put our brains together and figure that out. And then once we do that, let's figure out a second one. Let's figure out a third one. And that allowed us to grow. It allowed us to not have indigestion, thinking, how are we going to deal with food move? How are we going to deal with freight laws in the Southwest and storage laws in the Northeast and things like that? And we just learned as we went along. It wasn't entirely intentional, but in retrospect, I'm glad we did do it that way.
Are you planning to stick with FarmLink after your graduation this year?
Yeah, I am. I'm going to work full time. I've been working full time-ish with school. I've been trying to balance myself and so many other people have been trying to balance school with this. Yeah. And we have a lot of members who are young, but out of school. So they're balancing school and however they make money on the side, which is an incredible thing because this can be on a busy week, like a 50-hour, 60-hour plus work week. And next year, I'm excited to just have that to be focused on.
Yeah, totally. It definitely helps. Off topic, but how has the pandemic school experience been for you being in college? I couldn't imagine being in college at the time, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm lucky because I've been here all year and I'm lucky for a couple of reasons. One, I have an off-campus.
Helps a ton.
Which provides a little more space. And I also have roommates that I like, which I think is maybe goes without saying, but if some people end up at house and they don't like them and they weren't planning on being, you know, in the house with them every second of the day. I feel lucky to have great roommates that are really good friends that I love and at a good place. But just like any of us sitting at the computer, sometimes 10, 12 hours a day. And I think at school there, on top of that, there's a little bit of an edge of anxiety. That's because it's hard to keep 6,000, 21-year-olds roped in, and people will go and have social events, things like that. And then kids get suspended or there are COVID outbreaks. And so it has that sort of lingering feeling of paranoia, is maybe a little dramatic, but I think you get what I'm saying.
Yeah. I hear you.
Yeah.
Anxiety.
Yeah. Anxiety.
To get back on topic there, I'm just curious. One related thing that's happened in other countries is in France, since 2016, large grocery stores have been banned from throwing away unsold food that could be donated to charities. And obviously you're working at this from the other angle of this is food that's not even making it to those stores. But are there opportunities to institute similar legislation within the United States or create other programs that you see working here? What kind of barriers do you see from your experience now dealing with this problem?
Yeah, I can talk to one that's an interesting link, which is that, for example, in the United States, we just announced yesterday that we plan on cutting emissions in half by 2030. And a huge factor in that is food waste. And that's what we deal with. And that's why I can speak more to that than, for example, the restaurant side of things, because we focus on this on-farm food waste, which accounts for, I believe, 10 to 11%. It accounts for a significant portion of this 100 billion pounds that we throw out per year. If food waste were a country, it would be the third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions behind China.
Wow.
In the United States. But it accounts for 11% of global emissions. The United States wastes by far the most out of any other country. And in order for us to attain that goal of reducing emissions by half within the next 9 years, we're going to need to make significant changes in our food system. Food waste is a symptom of having these large scale industrial farms that are expected to produce millions and millions of pounds of food to keep grocery store shelves stocked with anything anyone could want at any time of the year. And the effects are going to resonate. It might require lifestyle changes from people within the US, but it's also going to be hopefully incentivized by the government, subsidized perhaps for these farms to start seriously changing their outlook on how they waste their surplus. And what I need to also mention at the same time, well, that it is not a choice from these farmers aren't sitting there thinking, I don't care, I'm going to throw this food out because I don't care about the environment. It's just a product of the system that they're forced to. They do not like having to throw out food that they worked to grow over the past season.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think that's an important point for everyone who's listening to think about. This is a systemic problem, not one of individuals not wanting to feed the hungry. It's something where because of the system they're in, they can't afford to do that work, or they simply don't have the capacity to do that work. Yeah.
They're going to work minute to minute, basically, as soon as one season's over, start planting for the next, even before. I talk to farmers who say, I have this much food. It breaks my heart to have to throw this out, but I simply cannot pay to have this refrigerated. I do not have the time to figure out where to put it or how to get it there because I have to put food on the table for my family, and that takes priority.
Are you thinking now about ways that you can affect public policy around food waste, or is that something that's often the 1-2 year plan kind of thing?
No, absolutely. It's a give a man a fish or teach a man a fish kind of thing. It's like we can deliver as much food as we'd like, but if we can't fix the policy change, then how deep is our impact going to truly be? So we have a lot of people on the team who are extremely passionate about examining policy that has led us to get to this point and how we can change it. And that's our policy. Our main goal is to get more involved with organizations like Alliance to End Hunger is one, where they bring together hundreds of social change organizations in the food space so that we can go petition and maybe make change in group in Washington. And then in addition to that, with our learnings, we also publish a lot of what we're researching and writing. And that's through our impact articles that we release on our website. And in that way, I think we're trying to have a two-pronged effect of both becoming more of a voice in policy change and educating people who didn't know before.
And I have to say, think this has been really interesting. And I love that you took your free time essentially after the pandemic hit and said, let's help solve this problem. So thank you for everything you and James and everyone else has done to work on this food waste problem. As you mentioned, it's that if this was a country, food waste would be the third largest source of climate emissions. And so we absolutely have to address it if we're going to hit our climate goals. Is there anything that you want to make sure to highlight that we haven't talked about yet?
No, I always try to reiterate that if you are someone who feels like, oh, I don't know how to help, or if I go volunteer, I never feel like I'm truly making an impact, or come join. And if you think, oh, I don't know anything about trade or policy, or I feel behind, or I work in marketing, come join. Neither did any of us when we started doing this.
Great point.
Neither did any of the volunteers who came on in the winter, or the fall, or the summer. That's our whole thing. And those are the people we try to attract, are not people who are necessarily experts, but people who just really care and want to see their hours turned into, you know, legitimate change and help for people who need it. Go to our website, go look at the ways that we offer for you to come help and volunteer. We have anything ranging from a couple of hours a week to becoming a full-time team member. Just give it a try. It's an amazing community.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Aiden. That's farmlinkproject.org. Check them out. And thanks again, Aiden, for coming on.
Thank you, Connor.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Growing the Green Economy. If you can take 30 seconds to subscribe, share, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, it's hugely helpful. These metrics drive how the show gets discovered, and you taking 30 seconds to support the show means the world to me. You can find me on Twitter, YouTube, Twitch, and across social media at Connor Bronsden. Thanks for listening.